"Isn't it strange," she asked the hushed group, "how the seed of one handsome man could have produced so much beauty in these islands? I know it's fashionable to laugh at old maids who haven't married, and I'm sure you'll think me vain if I claim that when I was young, I too was a typical Whipple beauty. Kimiko, fetch me that portrait in the bedroom." And the Japanese maid silently brought in one of the last great portraits completed by Sargent. And it showed a glowing young beauty in white, with lace and combs. And Lucinda said, "That's what I mean by the Whipple complexion. You have it, Noilani, and it's a great consolation to me to think that it will be reunited with the male side of the Whipple family. What handsome children you are bound to have." The maid stood awkwardly with the heavy picture, and Miss Lucinda said, "You may take it back, Kimiko." And when the maid was gone, she confided, "Sargent did that of me when I was engaged to an Englishman, but Father felt that it would be better if I found a young man closer to home, and, as you know, I became engaged to my cousin Horace Whipple, but he..." She hesitated. Then, realizing that all of her listeners, except perhaps Noelani, knew the story anyway, she concluded, "Before the wedding, Horace shot himself. At first, it was suspected that he might have stolen money from J&W, but of course that was quickly disproved, for there has never been a case of theft in the family." "Which family?" Noelani asked. "The family. All of us," Aunt Lucinda replied. And when her nephew Hawksworth had departed with his attractive daughter, she summoned Kimiko to refill the glasses, remarking, "That Noelani is one of the loveliest these islands have ever produced. She did marvelously well at Wellesley, and I think we're lucky that she's come home to marry with her proper kind. After all, she comes from excellent stock." It was a major characteristic of Hawaii that everyone claimed distinguished ancestors. In 1949, there were no Hawaiians who were not descended from kings. The Hales had constructed the myth that cantankerous old Abner, from the miserable farm near Marlborough, had been, were the truth known, of knightly ancestry dating far back in English history. The Keys never mentioned the fact that their progenitor was a shifty little gambler who had bought his concubine from a Macau whorehouse. He was, if you listen closely, something of a Confucian scholar. And even Mrs. Yoriko Sakagawa always loved to tell her children, "Remember that on your mother's side you come from samurai stock." Of all these gentle fables, only Mrs. Sakagawa's was true. In 1703, the great lord of Hiroshima had had as one of his flunkies a stocky, stupid oaf whose principal job it was to stand with a feathered staff, warning away chance intruders when his lord was going to the toilet. Technically, this male chambermaid was a samurai, but he had been too stupid even to hold the toilet signal well, and after a while had been discharged and sent back to his home village, where he married a local girl and became the ancestor of Yoriko Sakagawa. And if she, like the others in Hawaii, derived consolation from her supposed illustrious heritage, no harm was done. The Hale-Janders wedding was a splendid affair, held in the flower-decked old missionary church, with Reverend Timothy Hewlett officiating. But as I said earlier, it only seemed that Goro Sakagawa was having more domestic trouble than his adversary, Hawksworth Hale. For Noilani and Whipple had been married only 4 months, when Whipple suddenly announced out of a clear blue sky, if ever an announcement were so made, "I just don't love you, Noilani." "What?" she asked in heartbroken astonishment. "I'm going to live in San Francisco," he said simply. "Is there some other girl?" Noilani pleaded, without shame. "No, I guess I just don't like girls," he explained. "Whip, there's nothing wrong with you, no, but Eddie Shane and I are taking an apartment. He's the fellow I was with in the Air Corps." "Oh my God, Whip, have you talked with anyone about this?" "Look, no, don't make a federal case of it, please. Marriage isn't for me, that's all." "But you're willing to marry Eddie Shane, is that it?" "If you want to put it that way, all right, I am." He left Hawaii, and word filtered back that he and Eddie Shane had a large apartment in the North Beach area of San Francisco, where Eddie made ceramics which were featured in Life magazine in color. Aunt Lucinda loved to explain what had happened. She said, as Kimiko passed the gin, "Go back to Micah Hale's daughter, Mary. This girl was 1/8 Hawaiian through her mother, Malama Hawksworth, who was the daughter of Noelani Kanakoa, the last Ali'i Nui. Now, that's bad enough. But as you know, Mary Hale married a Janders, and you'd expect that rugged stock to have counterbalanced the weak Hawaiian strain. But unfortunately, she married into the Janders line that had married one of the Hewlett girls, and, as you know, they were Hawaiian. So poor Whipple Janders, when he ran off with the Air Corps man, was only doing what could be expected, because he had Hawaiian blood from both sides of his family." But Hawksworth Hale, seeing the effect of this pathetic marriage on his high-strung daughter Noelani, thought, "Unless I can help her, there's going to be another woman sitting upstairs in the late afternoons." But what help he should offer, he did not know. In 1951, Nguyễn Xin engineered her last big coup for the Kỳ Hụi, and in many ways it was her most typical accomplishment, for it derived from intelligence and was attained through courage. She was 104 years old, sitting in her ugly house up Nu'uanu, listening to her grandson Harvey read the paper to her, when, in a shaky old voice, she interrupted, "What's that again?" Since Harvey was reading in English and speaking in Hakka, he could not be certain that he himself understood the confusing story. So, phrase by phrase, he repeated. In American business today, it is possible for a company which is losing money to be more valuable than it was a few years ago when it was making money. Impetuously, the old matriarch forced her grandson to read the strange concept 3 times, and when she had comprehended it, she said in her piping voice, "That's exactly the kind of trick smart Haoles think up for themselves, and which we stupid Chinese never catch on to until it's too late." Accordingly, she summoned her great-grandson Eddie, Hong Kong's boy, whom she had sent to Harvard Law School, and told him, "I want a complete report on how this works." At that time, not much was known in Hawaii relating to this marriage of losing companies to those that were prosperous. But Eddie Key applied himself to the task of assembling opinions from mainland tax courts, and within 2 months he was an expert in the field. Then, with several tax reports airmailed in from New York, he reported back to his grandmother in her little house. And when he came upon her, she was picking lint from a shawl, and he thought, "How can she be so old and yet so interested?" "Can you explain it now?" she asked in a high, cackling voice. "Fundamentally," Eddie began in his best professional style, "it's an old law and a good one." "I don't care whether it's good or bad," Nguyễn Xin interrupted, her voice suddenly lower. "What I want to know is how it works." "Take the Janders Brewery. For years it's been losing money. Now, suppose next year it makes money. It won't have to pay any taxes, because recent years' losses can be used to offset next year's gains." "Makes sense," Nguyễn Xin nodded. "But look at what else we can do," Eddie lectured stolidly, as if addressing a class of legal students. "If the Kỳ Hụi buys the brewery, we can then add to its assets all of our old pineapple land. Then, if the brewery sells the land, the profits will be offset by the past losses of the brewery. Do you see what that means, Wu Chao's auntie?" Little Nguyễn Xin did not reply. She sat in the late afternoon sun like a winsome old lady embroidered on a Chinese silk. She was smiling, and if an outsider had seen her beatific wrinkled face, he might have thought, "She's dreaming of an old love." But he would have been wrong. She was dreaming of the Janders Brewery, and she said, "How heavenly! We can use the Janders losses to balance the key profits." "Wu Chao's auntie," Eddie cried, "you see exactly what I'm talking about." "But I'm afraid you don't see what I've been talking about," Nguyễn Xin replied. "What do you mean?" Eddie asked. Suppose that we do buy the Janders Brewery and do hide our pineapple lands inside it, she began. That's what I've been explaining, Eddie said gently. It was the first sign that day that Wu Chao's auntie was losing her acuity. But what I'm explaining, Yuk Tsin said firmly, is that after we have done this clever thing, we will put some member of our family in charge of the brewery, and he will give it good management, and he will turn what has been a loss into a profit. Now the beatific smile passed over to Eddie's face, and he said, If you could arrange that, Wu Chao's auntie, we'd make a fortune. That's what I had in mind, the old woman replied. This law seems to have been expressly written for the Qi Hui. It is our duty to use it sagaciously. She summoned Hong Kong, and after discussing the theory of the law, told him abruptly, Make us up a list of all the companies in Honolulu that are losing big money. Then write alongside each one the name of someone in our Hui who could turn that loss into a profit. Where will we get the money to buy the sick companies? Hong Kong parried. We don't have to buy them for cash, Nyuk Tsin replied, but we'll need money for down payments. So we have to sell some of our holdings now and pay the taxes on our profits. But if the plan works, we'll more than make up for those taxes in the end. Are you determined to go ahead on such a wild scheme? Hong Kong asked. Getting rid of profitable businesses in order to take a big gamble? Nyuk Tsin reflected a moment, then asked Eddie, Does anyone else in Honolulu understand how this law works? They must know, the Harvard man replied, but they aren't doing anything about it. Nyuk Tsin made up her mind. Clapping her hands sharply, she said, We'll go ahead. In 6 months, everyone will know what we're doing, but by then there'll be nothing left to buy. And as Hong Kong and his son departed, old Nyuk Tsin looked at the back of the latter and thought, I wonder what his education at Harvard cost us. It's been worth rubies and jade. The next day, Hong Kong returned to the weather-beaten old house up Nuuanu with his homework well done. Spreading papers which Nyuk Tsin could not read, he indicated all the businesses that had accumulated large losses. The brewery, a taxicab company, a chain of bakeries, some old office buildings, some stores. But now the perpetual drive of Nyuk Tsin manifested itself with unbroken force, and as each item was listed she asked simply, How much fee simple land does it have? And if Hong Kong said that it owned no land of its own, she snorted, Strike it off. Even better than accumulated back losses is land. So the final list that the Keys were going to buy contained only companies with big losses and bigger parcels of land. But when Nyuk Tsin heard Hong Kong's second list, the key holdings that were to be liquidated to cover the new purchases, she perceived with displeasure that the biggest project of all was missing, and she wondered why. Beginning querulously and with a piping voice, she said, This is a good list, Hong Kong. Hong Kong smiled and observed expansively, Well, I thought we might as well get rid of the old projects. But if I heard your list correctly, Nyuk Tsin continued softly, there was no suggestion that we sell the land upon which we are now sitting. Hong Kong looked with some embarrassment at his son Eddie, but neither spoke, so Nyuk Tsin continued, Surely, if we need money for new ventures, we ought to sell first of all this old taro patch and everything on it. Didn't you think of that? In a burst of confidence, Hong Kong said, Of course we thought of it, Wu Chao's auntie, but we considered this land too precious to you. We cannot sell it during your lifetime. Thank you, Hong Kong, the old woman replied, bowing her thin gray head. But one of the reasons why this idea of selling old businesses to go into new is appealing to me is that we will not only make money, but we will also be forced into many new operations. We will have to work, and will not be allowed to grow lazy and fat. She folded her hands, smiled at her clever men, and added, Have you noticed, Hong Kong, how every Chinese family that tries to hold on to old businesses loses everything in the end? But you always preach to us, hold on to the land, Hong Kong protested. Ah, yes, Nyuk-tsin agreed, but not always the same land. Then she added, old land and old ideas must be constantly surrendered. A new concept had come into the room, a concept of change and going forwardness. And for some moments Hong Kong and his son contemplated the old woman's vision of a great family always in flux and always working hard to profit from it. The silence was broken by Nyuk-tsin, who said, so we must sell this precious old land, Hong Kong, and in our liquidation let it be the first to go. The land we will sell, Hong Kong said quietly, but we will keep the old house for a little while longer. I could not imagine you living anywhere else. Thank you, my dutiful grandson, Nyuk-tsin replied. Then, briskly, she added, so we must start this day teaching Bill how to run a brewery. Sam must study how to make money from bakeries. And I want Tom to begin reading about new ideas in architecture for old buildings. She proposed ways by which every losing venture they were about to buy could be transformed into a moneymaker. And she warned, Hong Kong, you must study carefully to see that we acquire only the best land. Eddie, organize everything in the best business procedure. I must depend upon you too to keep your eyes on everything. As the meeting was about to break up, the old matriarch said, it's very exciting to see a family launching out into bold new projects. You'll be proud of this day. But remember, Hong Kong, as you buy, be very secret and do it all at once. And when you buy, always allow yourself to be forced into paying a little more than the seller has a right to hope for. When your plan is understood by all, nobody must feel he's been cheated. She paused, then added, but don't pay too much more. 3 weeks later, at a meeting of the fort, Bluff Hewlett Janders laughed and said, if we didn't follow the old missionary law about no alcohol here, I'd send out and buy drinks all around. Good news? John Whipple Hawksworth asked. The best. Just managed to unload the brewery. What a millstone it's been. My sainted grandmother told me once, if she told me 100 times, no good will come of a hail going into the brewery business. And she was so right. Get a good price for it? Hawksworth Hale asked. I got $35,000 more than I ever hoped to, Janders replied. I've been wanting to stick Hong Kong Key ever since he pulled that fast one in buying the Gregory's leases. Did you say Hong Kong? Hawksworth asked. Yes. He slipped this time. Nobody can make money from that brewery. That's odd, Hale said. I just sold Hong Kong the old Bromley block. It's been losing money for years. At this point, one of the Hewletts arrived with the good news that he had unloaded the taxicab company. To Hong Kong Key? A chorus asked. Yes, and at a good price, young Hewlett replied. A gray silence fell over the boardroom while Hale looked at Janders and Janders at Hewlett. Have we been made fools of? Hawksworth asked slowly. Finally, Doer John Whipple Hawksworth said glumly, I guess it's my turn to confess. I just sold Hong Kong that chain of bakeries we started before the war. Big losers. What's he up to? Hewlett Janders cried. What's that tricky Chinaman up to? It must be real estate. He's buying property just to get real estate. No, one of the young Hewletts interrupted, because he just sold the old Key tarot patch for $1,000,005. My God, Janders choked. He's selling, he's buying. What's that wily son of a bitch up to? The men looked at one another in exasperation, not so much because they were angry at Hong Kong, as because they suspected that he had some clever deal cooking, one which they ought to have anticipated for themselves. The deal was clever. In truth it was, but only the first half. Anyone, if he had had the advice of a hard-working lawyer like Eddie Key, could have bought losing firms and sold prosperous ones, making a nice profit on the transaction. That was clever. But what really counted was the fact that Bill Key, backstopped by his father Hong Kong and his smart brother Eddie, was learning how to brew fairly good beer. It wasn't easy, and some of the first batches, introduced by a florid advertising hullabaloo featuring the slogan, "Key Beer, Your Key to Happiness," was dreadful stuff, which the local population christened Chinese arsenic. But soon, with the aid of a Swiss German whom the Hui flew in from St. Louis, the beer began to taste reasonably palatable. And since it sold for a nickel a can less than others, working men began acquiring a taste for it. So, without even considering the $1,800,000 worth of real estate on which the old Janders Brewery had sat, the Ki Hui made a very strong profit out of that particular tax purchase. But the big moneymaker, to everyone's surprise, turned out to be the bakeries. Each store brought with it enough real estate so that of itself the deal was favorable. But Sam Ki, at the age of 64, discovered a real affinity for selling cakes, and he showed substantial profits on each unit in the chain. Not all the projects turned out so well. For example, the taxicab company resisted every attempt to make it pay. And finally, Hong Kong reported to his grandmother, "This one is no good." "Give it away," Nguyen Tsin replied. "I hate to surrender so easily," Hong Kong protested. "There ought to be some way to make money out of taxicabs." "Somebody else probably can," Nguyen Tsin agreed, "but not the keys. Anyway, I don't like taxis. They seem to aim at me whenever I go out. By the way, I saw what Tom is doing to the old Bromley block, and he's making it into quite a handsome building. If we had traded even, giving away the taro patch for the Bromley block, we'd still have been ahead. I like to see the family working," she said. And as the year ended, her 104th, she sat in her little house at midnight, and with a flickering oil lamp she undressed, until she stood completely naked, a tremendously frail old woman made up mostly of bones. And with the lamp moving cautiously near her body, she inspected herself for leprosy. There were no spots on her hands, none on her torso, none on her legs. Now she sat down and lifted in turn each of her ungainly big feet. There were no spots on the toes, none on the heel, none at the ankles. At peace for another night, she slipped into a flannel nightgown, blew out the lamp, and went to sleep. The coup which Nguyen Tsin had engineered had one unexpected result. The fort, after it had an opportunity to study exactly what Hong Kong Ki had accomplished by his revolutionary manipulations, concluded, in the words of Hawksworth Hale, "We could use a man like that on some of our boards," and everyone agreed that the man had a master intellect. After one of the meetings of Whipple Oil Imports Incorporated, Hawksworth asked his fellow board member jokingly, "Hong Kong, now that the Gregory's deal is over and nobody got too badly hurt, are you happy that you sneaked the outfit into Hawaii?" "What do you mean?" Hong Kong asked. "Well," Hawksworth pointed out amiably, for he was growing to like the clever Chinese, whose business judgments usually proved sound, "Gregory's has been here for nearly 5 years. They've taken enormous sums out of the territory. But what have they done for Hawaii?" "Like what?" Hong Kong asked. "Like museums, schools, libraries, medical foundations." Hong Kong thought a while and said in apparent seriousness, "Every year the manager of Gregory's